Our first reading this morning is from Aftershock, Robert Reich's book, which was published last year. Reich, you know, may recall, was labor secretary under President Clinton, a prolific author and commentator. He's on TV and on the radio. Reich is now on the faculty of the Goldman School of Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. And he says this.
A virtual pendulum underlies the American political economy. We swing from eras in which the benefits of economic growth are concentrated in fewer hands to those in which the gains are more broadly shared, and then back again. We are approaching the end of one such cycle and the start of the next. The great prosperity of 1947 to 1975 was followed by three decades of retrenchment, ending in the Great Recession. The question is not whether the pendulum will swing back again. It surely will. The question is how it will swing, whether with reforms that widen the circle of prosperity, or with demagoguery that turns America away from the rest of the world, shrinks the economy, and sets Americans against one another.
Our second reading today is from Sue Halpern's collection of essays from 1993 titled Migrations to Solitude. While short, her piece speaks for itself. Trusting each other is the beginning of a certain secular faith, a faith that allows us to live in families and communities and nations. Democracy, above all other forms of government, requires this faith. Thank you, Nathan. Thank you. In a suburb of Johannesburg, I met with three women who had all been active in the liberation struggle there. A black African, a woman who had been born in England, and a woman of Indian descent. While we were introducing ourselves, the Indian woman changed gears by asking me, "What is the population of the United States?" Puzzled, I replied, just under 300 million, I think. This was in 2003. We've reached that milestone now. She replied, that's the size of our middle class in India. She said, looking rather satisfied. Okay, this might be interesting, I thought to myself. A pissing contest about national economies. I get it. How fun. I was going to respond in kind, saying something about how our middle class was about 70% of our population, while in India it was a third at best. But then I realized I didn't know what that percentage really was here in the United States. And even so, I was pretty sure that in India that their middle class was growing, while I knew that ours here in the States was getting smaller every day. I don't think I was aware of it then. But something about being so far from home and hearing the U.S. criticized put me on the defensive. I wasn't used to defending the United States. I was used to being the one criticizing how we had let our promise slip away. Thankfully, one of the others at the table steered us gracefully back to the safer topic of South African liberation. Even so, the memory of that brief exchange has stayed with me. When I was growing up, we learned the evils of the Gilded Age, the age of robber barons and ugly, smoky smoke billowing from endless industrial smokestacks, of fat cat bankers, and all those who fled to the cities looking for work, giving up everything in the process, only to find that they had accepted what seemed again and again and again like a devil's bargain. We were told in school such profiteering was un-American and certainly undemocratic. We had righted those wrongs, the teacher said, and things were back on track and were going to stay that way. History never repeats itself, we were told. And those of us who felt our families were doing okay, well, we believed it. Now, we have seen those who have speculated recklessly held up as being too big to fail. We have seen Wall Street bailouts and taxpayer-funded, temporarily decreased annual bonuses. Of course, what led to all that was the eradication of protections put in place in the aftermath of the Depression. The jobs that have been lost now will not come again in the same way, and salaries that have been effectively flat for decades now are only a dream away, as those who are out of work and have been out of work can be almost certain that if they do find work again, it will not be at the same rate they were paid before. Our beloved, much lauded middle class has taken more than just a body blow these last few years. History never repeats itself, but it sure can rhyme, Mark Twain reminds us. And still, somehow, the American dream seems to persist. E pluribus unum. Out of many, one. These were the words with which Daniel Hernandez, the brave volunteer in Representative Gabriel Gifford's office, began his remarks at the memorial service in Tucson a week ago Wednesday. Hernandez called on our nation to unite, and in the aftermath of the senseless violence in Tucson, we have, to a degree. He may not wish to consider himself a hero, Daniel Hernandez, but he ran forward toward the sound of gunfire on his own volition, instinct even. He stayed with Giffords, tending to her wound and holding her hand until the ambulance drove her away. What is not heroic about that? We know that there are moments in our nation when our citizens simply shine. Hernandez shone that day, and he did so again during the memorial. We learned of another such shining American moment in the story of Ron McNair, which Ruby told earlier. A precocious young boy who jumped up on a counter at the library when the librarian wouldn't let him check books out on his own. Blacks didn't get library cards back then in Lake City, South Carolina. Well, until Ron's act of civil disobedience, that is. And in another case of being seemingly too good to be true, Ron, that little boy who checked out books, not of other people that looked like him, but of airplanes because they caught his fancy, Ron grew up to become a real live astronaut. I'm not making this up. Only luck was not with him, as an accident took his life and that of the others on the Space Shuttle Challenger 25 years ago this week. A friend of mine who lives here in town, her brother knew Ron McNair. African Americans are not, and certainly were not then, the norm at NASA, and those that were there made sure to connect. The library in Lake City, South Carolina, is now dedicated to McNair, and libraries everywhere in our nation check out books to future astronauts, teachers, nurses, and even future circus performers. While this may have seemed like a diversion from my topic earlier, my hope is to remind us that there is something in the American dream that may be still alive. There may be still some chords that we respond to. Remember Sue Halpern's words earlier. Trusting each other is the beginning of a certain secular faith, a faith that allows us to live in families and communities and nations. Democracy, she continues, above all other forms of government, requires this faith. And it is this faith, whether secular or not, that I want most to talk with you about today. It begins with finding and building upon the ways we can still trust one another. Yet it can be hard to feel trusting, united in common cause, when the deck seems stacked against you. The promise of our nation is, in the immortal words of Abraham Lincoln, that government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from this earth. These days, a government of the people and by the people feels like a dream to me, let alone how long it's going to last. I was crying tears of joy, along with Jesse Jackson and so many others in Grant Park the night Barack Obama was elected president. I don't assume that all of you share those tears with me. This is just where my experience. I know we're going to disagree, and that's good. We just need to share those disagreements, our values, as openly and respectfully as we can. And while I know that politics is the art of the possible, I was hoping, like so many others, for more backbone from Obama, especially in economic matters. Robert Reich again. A virtual pendulum underlies the American political economy. We swing from eras in which the benefits of economic growth are concentrated in fewer hands to those in which the gains are more broadly shared, and then back again. We are approaching the end of one such cycle, he claims, and the start of the next. Really? Really? I'd like to hope so, but I'm not sure I see it or signs leading that way. In their book, Winner Take All Politics, authors Jacob Happer and Paul Pearson take a painfully clear-eyed look at the state of our economy over the last several decades. They show that from shortly after the Second World War into the early 70s, incomes grew across the scale for all wage groups, and wages even grew slightly faster at the bottom and middle end of the scale than at the top. That started changing before the end of the 70s. We need to remember that. Before Reagan took office, the decline had begun. According to the Congressional Budget Office, from 1979 to 2006, average after-tax inflation, inflation-adjusted incomes rose 11% for families in the lowest 20% of our households, 18% for the next, 21% for the middle group, 55% for the next, that would be the upper middle class, and get this, 256% for those at the top. Those at the bottom, from 79 to 2006, incomes rose, inflation adjusted, 11%. Those at the top, 256 times. And that is during a time when many more families had more than one wage earner. Women went into the workforce, and still, those gains were only what they were. Unless you were ones of the lucky ones, they must have been working so much harder than the rest of us. Thank you. One more point. Without the extra wage earners, incomes at the households at the bottom would have fallen during those decades. I don't want to forget that. Additionally, the period of 2001 through 2007, and I'm quoting now, was the first economic expansion on record in which the typical non-elderly household lost economic ground. The aughts were a hard decade for all of us. As the authors put it, recessions, it turned out, were for suckers, not bankers. And also, where the conventional wisdom confidently declared it's the economy, stupid. Remember that line? The authors found again and again it was the politics, not the economy. Elsewhere in his book, Aftershock, Reich speaks to this when he writes, "Perhaps the most convincing evidence that the game is rigged is the deafening silence about all of this." And in a helpful image of the scale of the problem, he adds, "America's rich did take a hit in the crash of 2008. According to Forbes magazine, the nation's 400 wealthiest people lost about $300 billion that year. That still left those 400 with enough to live on, a total of $1.27 trillion. More than the estimated cost of achieving universal health care for the entire nation for the next decade. 400 people have enough wealth to fund our entire nation's whole health care for 10 years. A system that would allow such a thing is one that, as far as I'm concerned, is practicing slash-and-burn economics. And in case you think I'm making a partisan claim here, I want to remind you that I understand that the changes to our regulatory practices actually began under President Carter. The responsibility for this rests with Republicans and Democrats alike. Reich states at one point, losers of rigged games can become very angry. And yet the only cries I hear these days, cries of anger, are those from the Tea Party. Where is the wider outcry? Where is the angry middle? Where is the angry left? Or have we given up on crying out? I can only imagine that many of us are too scared to rock the boat that has served us or seemed to serve us well enough before. We can't help but think that things will turn around and we'll be able to get back on that boat again. To those whom our economy has not served as well, well, I hear them saying, "Welcome to the party. We're so glad you've chosen to join us. Now, do you understand what we've been trying to get you to hear for years now? This is a time to listen. This is a time for coming together and seeing if we can find common cause of sharing our stories despite our fear of shame. This is a time for humility and honesty. This is a time for either building or retreating, and I'm not advocating retreat." I was disheartened in all the reading I've done on the subject in recent weeks to find so many authors talking about a way forward as simply, well, maybe the best we can do is to muddle through, they seem to say, and sometimes said it just like that. Well, that may be an honest fallback position. I hope that we can strive for more. I'm not sure I'm ready to let go of the hope that more is still possible for us. Where the land of Ron McNair and Daniel Hernandez and Christina Taylor Greene, after all? As President Obama said in Tucson a week ago Wednesday, "I believe we can be better. Those who died here, those who saved lives here, they help me believe. We may not be able to stop all evil in the world, but I know that how we treat one another is entirely up to us. I believe that for all our imperfections, we are full of decency and goodness, and that the forces that divide us are not as strong as those that unite us. That's what I believe. In part, that's what a child like Christina Taylor Greene believed. In part because that's what a child like Christina Taylor Greene believed." Imagine, Obama continues, here was a young girl who was just becoming aware of our democracy, just beginning to understand the obligations of citizenship, just starting to glimpse the fact that someday, too, she might play a part in shaping her nation's future. She had been elected to her student council. She saw public service as something exciting, something hopeful. She was off to meet her congresswoman, someone she knew was sure was good and important and might be a role model. She saw all this through the eyes of a child, undimmed by the cynicism or vitriol that we adults all too often just take for granted. May Christina Taylor Greene and Daniel Hernandez and Ron McNair help us all believe. And may our efforts in the days and weeks to come inspire others of the same accord. Thank you.